Welcome to the IC Companies and Markets Show. It's Thursday, the 15th of September. I'm IC Deputy Editor Dan Jones. Joining me today are Ideas Editor Alex Newman.
Hi, Dan.
Deputy Companies Editor Julian Hoffman. Hi, Julian.
Hi, everyone.
Specialist Writer Jennifer Johnson.
Hi, everyone.
And our Economics Writer Hermione Taylor. Hello, Hermione.
Hello, thanks for having me.
We've got three main topics this week. We will be talking about ITM Power and its latest woes in our Result of the Week section. Then we're going to be looking at Trustonomics and UK finances. And finally, we're dropping in on the UK healthcare sector to look at the latest goings on at Advanced Medical Solutions and Abcam. But first, a roundup of the week's news. Let's start on energy. After concerns the government's energy support scheme for businesses faced delays, ministers have promised to backdate that support if necessary in a bid to shore up confidence for companies that face a cliff edge with their bills in the next few weeks. In Europe, the European Commission has outlined nascent plans to raise 140 billion euros from windfall taxes on a variety of different energy companies, as well as through introducing a mandatory threshold for prices charged by non-oil and gas producers. That comes as a note from Goldman Sachs actually says that Europe has effectively solved the problem of how to live without Russian gas and strikes a relatively upbeat tone about the prospects for the future. You can find out more details on both those points in the magazine this week. In the US, we've had inflation figures this week. Price growth dipped in August, the headline rate falling from 8.5 to 8.3%. But that was still hotter than expected and led to a minor equity sell-off as investors again factored in a tougher approach from the Federal Reserve as a result. UK inflation also dipped from 10.9% to 9.9% thanks to petrol prices falling, but core inflation continues to rise and food and services inflation in particular is still on the up. In UK retail news, Ocado has said it expects grocery sales for the 12 months to November to drop year on year for the first time, but ASOS has reaffirmed full year expectations and Dunelm has reported record full year results, albeit with the inevitable uncertain outlook. We cover those and many more results in this week's magazine as well. A bit of fund news, fund and trusts. The Fundsmith Emerging Equities Trust is set to be liquidated after the asset manager served notice on its contract. Fundsmith founder Terry Smith acknowledged that performance had been below expectations and suggested the asset manager no longer felt it had a particular edge in emerging markets amid a tough set of macro conditions there. And the FCA has said it plans to fine Link Fund Solutions, the administrator of the collapsed Woodford Equity Income Fund, up to £300 million when its investigation into the suspension and failure of that fund finally concludes. There is, however, still no specific date for that one yet. It's been a very long-running investigation. Finally, in this roundup, a couple of high-profile management changes. Rupert Soames is retiring as chief executive of Serco after 8 years in charge. And this morning, Shell boss Ben Van Beurden has said he will do likewise after a decade in charge there. So that brings us on to our result of the week, actually, because we are, as discussed, looking at ITM Power, where there is also going to be a change of management. But more significantly for investors, there's also been delays to revenue recognition on some of its key projects. Julian, you covered the results. I mean, obviously, this has been a bit of a big hope, ITM Power, you know, in terms of being at the forefront of the green hydrogen revolution, if such a thing materializes. But a bit of a disappointing set of results, really, in terms of what was announced.
Yeah, I mean, it was this was a total shuttle crash, really, to be honest. The company basically, what it did was overpromise what it could do in terms of getting its projects up and running. So they had a couple of big builds in the UK where they were going to build these hydrogen fuel cell power plants, effectively. One at a place called Bessemer, and they were looking at another place called Aviation Park, which I have no idea where that is.
I believe it's near Sheffield.
The problem they had was that the delays are forcing the revenues back into next year. So they essentially they've planned on the basis that their core project would be finished, and now it's not going to be finished, so they're not going to book the revenues until after the year end. So that made the numbers look increasingly horrible. So you know, so things like inventory went through the roof. So they had 4 million of inventory last year, and this year it's like 25 million. So there's a lot of capital that's sitting on the balance sheet not doing anything because it's just waiting to finish, really, waiting for projects to finish. But I mean, it does ask lots of questions about, you know, the operations of the company. And as you say, the CEO basically fell on his sword and left, although he said in the statement that he would somehow be maintaining his interest, or you know, maintaining his work with the group. But it really wasn't a happy result all round, I would say. And the question now is how to go forward. They have a lot of cash on the balance sheet, so they've got over 325 million of cash, so they can fund themselves without any trouble. So I don't think they'll be coming back to the market anytime soon. But it's the credibility of it all, which, you know, it's taken a big knock. And yeah, you saw that in the share price move on the day. It was down 25% in early trading as soon as the results became known. This kind of desperate situations, you just don't know how it's going to play out, whether the market now believes anything that the company says, or whether this could be a very good speculative play at the end of the day if someone picks the shares up really, really cheap. I mean, unfortunately for us, it was a buy tip in April that Alex Hamer put together, and I've had to send it on a trip to Zurich, unfortunately, at these results.
So, you publicly shamed him there, yeah.
I didn't mean to shame Alex, but we also, you know, there are times when we also get it wrong. We just have to acknowledge it. We all have these somewhere in our cupboard somewhere. I'm sure there's one of mine floating in the internet that's just a total disaster, but no way.
The credibility point is an interesting one. You know, we have had, you know, ITM, British Vault, a couple of weeks ago as well, suffering from similar, you know, delays in terms of where it's going to be able to get to versus expectations. You know, these are big picture companies and companies that a lot of people have pinned hopes on because of, you know, what they can plausibly or potentially hypothetically provide in terms of, you know, energy solutions in future. Do we think they're idiosyncratic issues? Are they, you know, bound up in the supply chain and energy cost issues that everyone's suffering from? You know, does it say something about what we should expect from nascent UK businesses and maybe how our expectations should be managed?
I mean, the thing is they're also not proven technologies on a mass scale. I think that's mm-hmm. the thing that people have to take into account when they try and value these companies. And you are starting to wonder whether the UK isn't a favoured destination for this. There was a very big US company backed by Amazon that was going to build a battery plant somewhere near Bristol, and they spent months and months negotiating it, and the government was going to give them bespoke planning permission. You know, all the NIMBYs were going to be cleared out and there wasn't going to be any problems with it, and then they pulled the investment at the last minute. And ostensibly over weird things like GDPR. I mean, like we're diverging in some of our rules with GDPR, and that means that they can't collect data to send back to the States. So you kind of, there are really odd side effects of diverging from certain types of rules. And you do wonder whether that isn't an inhibiting factor in how companies are investing at the moment, and whether that's also playing into the sort of very early technologies type businesses.
I'll come back to that in a minute, because ITM did have something to say about UK incentives. But I just want to bring in Alex on the topic of, you know, ITM in general. And again, yeah, as you say, it is a very nascent, unproven technology, hydrogen. Well, what's your sort of take on the results?
Yeah, I mean, I would say I think there is some proof of concept. It might not have been a long time since the concept's been proven, but we are at the ground level of, you know, which I think there's a strong argument to say this will be a very big industry. Hence the enormous interest and, you know, particularly at a retail investor level in this company and this project. And I think maybe we have to sort of separate the two stories almost, that there is the ITM Power, the enormously, in the last couple of years, enormously successful, you know, stock story. And then there is the industrial, long lead time, capital intensive, very difficult, very technical, requires lots of partnering with multinationals, story, which is always going to be a lot more difficult. And it's not, you know, things just don't go to the moon when you're dealing with so many things that can go wrong, really. So this week has obviously been, the shares are down 70% this year. This wasn't, you know, this isn't the first time the shares have fallen this year. But this year, I think, is when I suppose you'd say that sentiment has really hit bottom since, you know, since its rally over the last couple of years. And they probably kitchen sinked a few elements of this. I mean, Graham Cooley's been with the company since 2009. He might have looked at it and sensibly decided that, you know, someone else needs to come in now to take it to this next leg. And, you know, it's been a very difficult period for news for the company. And then you've got, you know, you have the valuation story as well. I mean, Julian said that, you know, they do have an enormous amount of cash on their balance sheet, having raised a couple of times in the last couple of years. That should see them through, one would imagine, over the next couple of years. But cash burn is so high when you're dealing with capital intensive projects, management, and all these working capital issues they're having, that could get eroded fairly quickly if, you know, their partnerships aren't put in working order in short order. I suppose to draw the bigger questions about how capable nascent British manufacturing or technology groups are at scaling up these industries. I mean, it's a very sort of difficult, complicated question here. I mean, you mentioned the point about incentives as well. Maybe that's another point to touch on.
Well, I suppose with the, as you mentioned as well, you know, working in partnership with bigger companies, multinationals, you know, IGM does have those relationships. I think Linde, the German US listed company, is the project at which this revenue recognition has been delayed. So it's not just an issue with a small UK company. You know, there's bigger issues at play there. And I think JCB are still a big backer as well. So clearly there are big companies, you know, literally invested in this project too. But yeah, on the question of incentives, I had a quick listen to the conference call, and it was interesting. I think it was Graham Cooley who said regarding Aviation Park, the project which has now been cancelled near Sheffield, what Cooley said, he said, quote, "We're seeing more and more incentives and deals to build factories all over the world where those incentives, and I'm talking about very significant contributions, are not available in the UK." Now, obviously, I don't think it's just those incentives that the reason why ITN's cancelled that park. Obviously, it's got operational issues elsewhere and needs to, you know, rein things in a bit. So it might seem a little bit like special pleading, but at the same time, you know, maybe the UK could be doing more to incentivize this kind of production and make sure these parks and these projects are built on our shores.
Well, I guess that's we'll wave the flag and say that's probably there probably needs to be more done about it. But we don't really have. They're trying to rebuild an industrial base that disappeared 30 years ago. So whether it's going to
easier said than done,
going to be easier said than done is exactly right. So you need the engineers that come out of universities, and they're very expensive. And trying to get it, you know, the money is there is one thing. I mean, actually, that point about partners is interesting. But one of the problems with having such a large partner like Linde in a project like this is that this is just a rounding mistake for Linde if they decide that they don't want anything more to do with it. Whereas that it's kind of terminal for ITM. You just got to hope that there isn't a change of board or management at the bigger company, and they decide, well, we're not going to go ahead with it.
I was going to say it's a very important point that, you know, just to return it to the shareholder question, it's important never to lose sight of this, that when it comes to committing billions of pounds, euros, dollars to projects, it's not necessarily the junior partner. In most cases, it won't be the junior partner which is going to reap the biggest long-term rewards. There's kind of some parallels here with Sirius Minerals as well, another nascent technology, if you can call it that. I mean, it's a substitute for traditional fertilizers we use, but there was so much hope invested in this company, and that, you know, the long-term cash flow generation projections going out sort of 30 years gave the illusion almost that this was all going to be captured by one company. When it comes to the crunch, you have to partner with government, you have to partner with multinationals like Linde, or in Sirius's cases, Anglo-American, who now own the project, with the, you know, with the capital to kind of swallow these, you know, these very difficult jobs. So, and then what happens is a lot of equity value disappears in smoke as hopes get dashed on the rocks of of economic reality of these projects.
Speaking of economic reality, we do, of course, have a new government in place with some new policies in certain areas, which does bring us on to our next segment, looking at what we've termed a couple of times this week as Trussonomics. That's UK finances, the UK fiscal position in general. Hermione Taylor, our economics writer, is here to discuss this issue. Let's start by returning to energy and the big commitments the government has made. How do we think that's going to affect the economy in the months ahead? We were looking at potentially a pretty long recession. Now, perhaps not. How do you see that playing out?
Well, the new energy policies are going to limit the amount that customers can be charged for each unit of electricity. And this means that average household bills should now be about £2,500. And expectations were that they were going to be £5,000 before the new policies came into play. So this should firstly reduce the squeeze on real household incomes, and it means that consumption might just keep us out of recession. There is a bit of debate amongst economists here, so some think that we'll manage to avoid a recession entirely. Others argue that we'll have a mild contraction, but it will be much less severe than we were expecting. So I think the good news is that the Bank of England's very gloomy predictions from last month, predicting a deep five-quarter recession, now look to be unfounded.
There are some other pieces to pick up from those policies as well. On the inflation side, the near apocalyptic predictions of 20% plus inflation in the year might be consigned to hypothetical history now, but maybe the glide path down is going to be more gradual as a result. So even though the recession is shallower, inflation might be with us for a bit longer.
Yeah, I mean, the impact of these new policies on inflation is slightly confusing because it will have different impacts in the short and long term. So there are different things driving UK inflation at the moment. So far, the biggest driver has been energy prices, but there are some domestic inflationary pressures as well. And these are things like wages increasing and firms putting prices up. So the new energy policies should really help with this energy price driven section of inflation. And that's why we're hopefully going to avoid these 20% rates and have something closer to 10%. But by increasing real household incomes, it could be likely that this demand driven segment of inflation stays higher for longer. So we won't have these huge peaks, but we might have elevated inflation for a longer period of time thanks to these new policies.
There's also the question of what the new government's policies in general do to gilt markets. Clearly, we have a situation where there's a lot of spending being committed just on energy alone. Is there a sense that some of the other mooted policies, tax cuts, etc., have been driving some of these really big moves in gilt markets we've seen in recent weeks?
I mean, I think gilt markets have got a huge amount to digest at the moment. So like you said, we've got these new energy policies. The government hasn't actually costed these yet, but economists think it's going to be about 150 billion, which is a huge sum. In addition to potential tax cuts, public finances are under strain anyway because of inflation. So quite a lot of commitments are inflation linked. We've got index linked gilts as 25% of our borrowing. Pensions and some benefits are inflation linked too. So that's putting spending under pressure. In addition to this, we've also got high inflation, which means we're in an environment of rising interest rates. And then we've got the likely commencement of quantitative tightening, which the Bank of England looks set to vote on next week. And that would mean that the gilt market needs to absorb an extra 80 billion just over the next 12 months from quantitative tightening alone. So gilt markets have got an awful lot to try and absorb at the moment.
Yeah, as you say, that process of reversing QE could potentially be quite significant, but it is certainly, well, it's unusual. It's unprecedented in that it's never been done before. So we'll see what happens there. The other aspect of the economics piece is the currency, is sterling. Again, there have been some fairly doomy predictions there. One analyst has made a headline-grabbing suggestion that there could be an EM-style crisis in the UK, but perhaps that's a little bit overplayed, I think it's fair to say.
So last week there was an analyst saying that an emerging market style crisis is possible, basically arguing that if the UK can't attract the foreign capital inflows that we need to fund our current account deficit, sterling would have to depreciate to bridge the gap. And they kind of calculated that in the event of a sudden stop in foreign capital inflows, sterling would need to depreciate by 30% to bridge the gap, which would be the kind of movements that you see in emerging markets. The true crisis isn't really likely for the United Kingdom because our external liabilities are in sterling. So this means that if the pound falls, the value of our external liabilities won't go up. And we also can't run out of currency that we need to pay for imports and kind of repayments in the same way that emerging economies can. If they need dollars, they can kind of simply run out. I think that a full-blown crisis isn't likely, but a further depreciation is possible. And we've got some economists saying that because of uncertainty over kind of public finances and our relatively poor growth and inflation outlook that we could even go as low as 105 against the dollar.
Yeah, as you say, you know, there is the dollar, you know, cross has been particularly painful in recent weeks. Sterling doesn't exist in a vacuum, and there is the fate of other currencies as well and what's happening there. And it seems this week with the Federal Reserve, you know, with those inflation numbers, the suggestion they're going to keep tightening for longer has obviously impacted the pound as well.
It might be worth saying as well that it's not just a function of the strong dollar. So if you look at a weighted basket of currencies, we're actually pretty down against everything, really.
Do me on all fronts at the moment. But speaking of the central bank, the Bank of England, and what it might potentially do there, there's also been a lot of comments about what the government might do to the Bank of England. You know, during the leadership contest, there was a lot of talk about the bank, its mandate, its oversight. Obviously, a lot of people are dissatisfied with it for obvious reasons. But when we look at what might actually happen down the track, is it fair to say the sense is the reality might prove milder than the suggestions made by these headlines?
I suspect that you're right there. So we had Truss's team in the run-up to the leadership election were quite adversarial. So we had, you know, statements about whether the bank's fit for purpose, even questioning independence. Since then, the new chancellor has written that he's fully committed to the independence of the Bank of England and that he believes in coordination across monetary policy and fiscal policy. So that certainly seems to have softened some possible changes to the Bank of England's mandate. Was a money supply target, a growth target, which it looks like they're going to introduce for the Treasury to kind of complement the Bank of England's target. So it certainly looks as though things are softening. There's also kind of a political point that any kind of review could take 18 months to 2 years, by which time inflation might be back down to target anyway. So we might find that the kind of driving forces behind a review to kind of fade away. For what it's worth, I think that that would be a shame. So I think that we are currently almost 8% above target inflation wise, and that some kind of performance review into how the bank is doing would be no bad thing.
We'll see how that pans out in the months ahead. Thank you. Let's turn, because we are approaching our final segment of the show now, and looking at a few more results this week in the healthcare, the biotech, the medical sector in the UK. A few companies reporting this week. Let's start with Advanced Medical Solutions, our pharma and healthcare correspondent. Jennifer Johnson is here. AMS, you know, it's another company which has, you know, had some ups and downs over recent years for obvious reasons when you talk about anything to do with healthcare. What do these results kind of signify? Where are they positioned right now?
So I think these results kind of show that companies which have kind of any exposure to hospitals are still kind of lagging behind in their recovery from the pandemic. Not that AMS kind of recorded a poor set of results, just that it's perhaps not bouncing back as quickly as might have been hoped. And this is because much really depends on whether there's a substantial new COVID wave as the winter approaches. And there are still, you know, issues with elective surgery cancellations. About 60% of AMS's revenue comes from its surgical division. And the company, just to sort of clarify and give context, makes tissue healing technologies, i.e. sutures and adhesives. So it's a significant portion of its revenue is made in hospitals where elective surgeries, while numbers might be recovering, I think in a lot of the markets that the company operates in, you still have these surgery cancellations happening. The impact of inflation also slightly diluted margins in the company's surgical division, as well as R&D investment. So what the company and this result really shows is that the medical sector, especially in the hospital setting, hasn't recovered in the way that pharmaceutical companies, which are sort of, you know, making research, doing research and making drugs in a lab context, have.
Yeah, I think, as you say, you know, they weren't a terrible set of results. They did have, you know, obviously coming from a lower base, but, you know, profits up, the dividend was raised. They're positive about the outlook, but yeah, is the question as to how much of this potential, I suppose, can be realised in the near term.
Yes, and that's where the risk of another winter COVID wave comes in. And that's why I think at this point it's wise to take a watch and wait approach to the company. Not that, as you mentioned, its results were bad, just that things could, again, take a turn for the worse if we perhaps have a new variant. Because, of course, in hospitals, if you have staff contracting COVID, those are kind of locations where you have a lot of people who are clinically vulnerable to the virus. So cancellations are inevitable, staff absences are inevitable. Much kind of depends on where the virus goes. And if we have this winter uptick, which I think epidemiologists are somewhat divided on at the moment, but for now, I think with AMS, it's the message is things are moving in the right direction, but we need to wait and see what the winter brings.
Let's talk about another company. Again, the company we've talked about a bit in recent weeks, Abcam, which is coming to the end of its life as a UK listed company now, had what may well prove to be its final set of results. We can talk about that listing change in a minute, but the results themselves, how do you see them?
So Abcam, I think, is quite an exciting company. Results largely positive, management quite bullish. They expect the company's adjusted operating profit margin to exceed 30% in 2024, up from 19.2% last year. So the message with Abcam really is it's a company that's growing. It's a maker of research use antibodies, which can be used by researchers in academic settings or in drug development. And most, I think it's now a majority of kind of research papers in this area now cite the use of an Abcam product. So they are a company that is growing. They are a company that has tremendous relevance in these lab settings. So the message with them really is it's an exciting company that's growing. However, as you mentioned before, there is the issue of the AIM delisting, which is coming up and is perhaps slightly troubling for UK shareholders. At this point, my understanding is that if the company goes through the process of delisting, as it's indicated that it will, there will be mechanisms in place to facilitate the conversion of shares. And the company does seem keen to support its AIM shareholders. So if that's kind of the one thing that might give investors or potential Abcam investors pause, really, is just that it's going to the US ostensibly in search of kind of deeper pocketed investors.
When I asked for your opinion, I was pretty much begging the question, because we did write it, or you did write it as an idea just the other week. So I know we're still pretty positive on the company's fortunes. But yeah, but in terms of that delisting, there is still the potential to access it via depository receipts in the US. I think the company said the other day, in terms of their plans, they're looking at mailing circulars in October, have the EGM in November, and then delist by the end of the year. But for those who want to stick with their holdings, the details will be in that circular. But I think they've just described it as almost a tick box opt-in kind of situation. So although there are issues with US holdings and monitoring of those holdings, I suppose, as well, depending on what platform you're on, there is still the ability to take part in this growth story. I'll just bring Julian back in, because I know you've written about both AMS and Abcam before, Julian. How do you find, you know, the state of those two companies at the moment? Do you tend to agree with Jen? Do you have a slightly different view?
Jen's spot on, really, with her analysis in both cases. I mean, sort of Advanced Medical Solutions is, in a sense, more problematic of the two, in that it is very focused on the UK and the home market, which is the home medical market is the NHS. There is no other provider. So that the long term prospects for them are based on how medical spending is going to go in the UK. And you kind of feel that they're the ones that have to come up with a plan to diversify what they're doing. They're very, they're tied into elective surgery. That's been affected by the pandemic. It's, a lot of people on waiting lists. It's nothing that's happening as quickly as it was a couple of years ago. So I think they're the more problematic. Abcam is just following the trend. I mean, there isn't enough capital that wants to put money into a relatively high-end speculative scientific venture, and the only place to do that for that kind of company is to go to the US. So it's there's no surprise in what they're doing, really. And in many ways, it's the logical and sensible one for its investors.
Yeah, I think as you say, they are a pretty sizable, multi-billion, $3 billion pound company now. So to an extent, it's the success that it's had on AIM has pushed it elsewhere, but it has been able to grow and flourish on that market. So I think there are still other companies hopefully will be hoping to, you know, follow its path in terms of, you know, growing on AIM and flourishing and showing that they can, you know, do that. We started, I suppose, what I'm saying is on a relatively negative note about ITM and some of the great prospects, but there are still those companies out there which can really deliver. But that does bring us to the end of today's show. So thank you to everyone for taking part. Thank you to Julian, Alex, Hermione and Jen. And thank you to you for listening. As ever, we'll be back next week with another Companies and Markets show. Goodbye.